current state contributor Joe Rexroad tweets, if the win over U of M counts as it should, MSU has a solid shot at the top four in the college football playoff. Joe describes Michigan State's win at Michigan middle of last month as one of the prime commodities obtained so far this season in college football. Tonight, of course, the first college football playoff rankings are announced. Tonight decides nothing, but on December 6th, the final rankings will determine the four-team playoff, of course. And Joel writes that tonight's rankings could reveal more about what the 12-person CFP selection committee values, like how important is your schedule, how much attention are they paying to really close games, injuries. We'll at least have tea leaves to look into here after 7 p.m. tonight. They're announced on ESPN. It's Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Money has always played a huge role in American politics. But since the U.S. Supreme Court Citizens United ruling in 2010, the financing of political campaigns has become even more controversial. Super PACs spend big money on campaigns, and often the names behind that money are kept secret. It's gotten to the point where a group of former lawmakers is beginning to work on reforming how political campaigns are paid for. Current State talks with a founding member of the Reformers. Who are they, Scott Pohl?
Well, Mark, they're people who have seen firsthand how the system has changed. Men and women from both sides of the aisle, though most of the Reformers at this time are Democrats. They've served in Congress, in the Senate, and in governor's offices. One of them is Bob Carr, who represented East Lansing in Congress for 18 years. He tells me he's been a reformer from the start.
Well, I have. There was a small group of us that we've been meeting for months. We're going to have our official launch this coming Thursday, November 5th, and there'll be some more publicity coming with that launch. But yes, I've been part of it from the beginning.
What are the goals of the reformers?
I think we basically ask the question, which is maybe on the minds of some who think about politics, and that is whether money in politics really supports or has now come to a point of hindering democracy. And we're troubled. All of us are troubled. We now, as of this morning, we are 107 former members of Congress, former governors, who have served, who've run campaigns, who've had to raise money, who had to make tough decisions about public policy, who have constituents that we've cared about and tried to represent, and yet we're becoming, 107 of us are becoming really concerned that the influence of money in politics today has gone beyond just supporting democracy and indeed is hindering or even corrupting the democracy that we cherish.
The Reformers' website lists a number of issues related to money in politics, and I'd like to go through them with you if I could. Here's the first. Elected officials, your group says, can't be effective when they have to spend half their time raising money for the next election cycle.
Well, it's just outrageous. Since I left Congress, this has steadily increased to the point where now both coalitions, the coalition of Democrats, the coalition of Republicans, are requiring of their seated members of Congress to spend upwards of 30 hours, logged 30 hours a week, on the telephone making calls for campaign contributions. And if you're in leadership or you're in a position of power, say a ranking or a chair of a committee, you're required to do even more. And, you know, it just takes away a lot of time, just sheer hours in the day that is taken away from doing the representational duties of the job. It is corrupting.
Another issue, leadership positions are given as rewards for fundraising rather than experience or expertise. Do you really think that's so?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I teach at George Washington University. I teach a course both in ethics and Congress. That's one course. Another course is the job of a member of Congress. I talk to members all the time, and they tell me that you've got to pony up to get a plum assignment. We used to have reforms that I was part of putting into effect in 1974. Sounds like a long time ago. where you had to campaign among your caucus to get a seat, move up on the committee structures. But today, it's all about the leadership. It's all about the party coalitions, and they're basically selling chairmanships and ranking memberships. Both parties do this. They're selling what is the public domain. These positions are not owned by the party.
You also think that qualified people are deciding not to run for office because they find the need to raise money to be so distasteful.
Well, I can not attest to that. I do know anecdotally that there are some stories out there and a few people that I know who might well have sought public service, but for the fact that they'd have to, I'll use a harsh term, prostitute themselves to, in their view, prostitute themselves to get enough money to run. Now, if you're independently wealthy, you don't have to do that, but then again, if you're independently wealthy, you don't have to listen to the constituents either.
We're talking with former Michigan Congressman Bob Carr about the Reformers, a group of more than 100 former office holders hoping to effect change in the election financing system.
I want to add that we're bipartisan. I mean, there are Republicans and Democrats who both are examining this situation and agreeing on the fundamental corrupting nature of our financing system of government.
Yes, my next question has to do with exactly that. On the list of members, here are the people from Michigan that I find on the list, along with you: Carl Levin, Jim Blanchard, and David Bonnier. Some other big names on the list of members: Walter Mondale, Gary Hart, Christine Todd Whitman, and Bill Bradley. Most, by my count, are Democrats, though, and given that Republicans control the House and the Senate, can the Reformers really influence campaign finance reform?
Well, I believe we can. For example, just today we added Jack Danforth, a former senator from the state of Missouri, a Republican. We have a large number of Republicans. There are more Democrats, but there are a large number of Republicans who actually agree with us. And we think we can. We believe that In the long term, we may have to confront the issue of Citizens United with a constitutional amendment. But short of that, there are any number of judicial fixes on peripheral issues to campaign financing that we can fight throughout the nation. And then on an incremental basis, a lot of the action is actually happening in the state level. So throughout we can do a lot of things on an incremental basis to help alleviate the situation. One of them is trying to confront the Internal Revenue Code. Right now, we have an Internal Revenue Code that allows essentially political groups to masquerade as nonprofit charities, hide their donors, and pretend that they are independent from campaigns. I mean, there are a lot of things we can do in that space, short of Citizens United confronting the current Supreme Court opinion. There's a lot of things we can do to fix that situation.
How much do we know about the new Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, and his positions on campaign finance reform?
Well, I think that we have a good chance. I don't know Paul Ryan personally. But I might parenthetically say, I know we're talking to a lot of people in East Lansing, which I consider my home, my hometown, but I was born and raised in Janesville, Wisconsin. And I know the environment out of which Paul was born and raised, and Janesville happens to be a Democratic town. He wins that congressional seat. So he's not one of these, and he's a thoughtful person. I don't agree with him on a lot of things, but I just know in my bones that Paul Ryan is the kind of person who probably cares about this as much as we do. How much latitude he has to maneuver relative to some of the more extreme elements of his party's coalition, I don't know, and that remains to be seen on this and other issues.
Bob Carr, you represented East Lansing in Congress for 18 out of 20 years between 1975 and 1995. Can you describe what fundraising for a congressional campaign was like for you in those days?
Well, yes. When I very first ran, and it was a losing race, I raised all of $50,000, and that was five times more than any Democrat in that district in the previous cycle. In my last race for Congress, I think I raised over $1 million, and then of course I left to run for the U.S. Senate. But the fact of the matter is, the amount of money that I had to raise was tremendous. Now, how did I do that? Well, I'm not a good fundraiser, frankly, and so I had to gather people around me who were adept at that, and I had some very good people working for me, and I never made the ask for the money. I'll tell you that I never made an ask for money. I had people on my staff who would arrange my schedule so that people on my campaign would put together events, and then I would go. I would make myself and my time available. But I never dialed for dollars the way they do today. I never went off the hill and sat on a telephone for 30 hours a week calling people, cold calling sometimes, people I didn't even know. They don't even know them today. They're calling them up and begging for money. It's just really unseemly. So I managed with a lot of help from friends. I never had big donors. We didn't have super PACs in those days, and certainly had none of these charitable organizations masquerading, so-called independent organizations masquerading as charitable organizations, raising money and then wink and a nod. And a secret handshake, not be independent from me. We never had any of that. So I served the people of the 6th and then 8th district without the kinds of pressures they have today. I may not have done it all right, but, I did the best I could, and I'm grateful for the people giving me that 18 years of trust.
M. Robert Carr is a former member of Congress from Michigan. He's part of a new group called the Reformers, former members of Congress and former governors working to change what they see as problems associated with campaign financing in the U.S. Your group is working on this. What's your advice to voters who are concerned with campaign finance reform?
Well, I think the thing I'd ask voters to do is ask the question. We all go to the polls and we all have things we care about. Life is busy. We've got jobs to keep. We've got kids to educate. We've got our parents to take care of in their retirement or in their declining years. There's a lot on everybody's plate. But if one of the reasons why we call this issue one is that we're trying to elevate this issue of money in politics as a primary motivator for voters in this election. We're not going to be able to make it a single-issue campaign. People have these other issues they want to have expressed, but we're trying to get more people to ask the question about financing and campaign. Where do you stand, Mr. or Ms. Congressman, on campaign finance reform?
And vote accordingly?
And vote accordingly, yes. Across party lines, yes.
Bob Carr represented Michigan's 6th and 8th districts in Congress for 18 out of 20 years between 1975 and 1995. He's a member of a group of former members of Congress, U.S. senators, and governors called the Reformers. The organization hopes to effect change in the American campaign finance system. Bob Carr, thank you.
You're welcome, Scott. Nice to be with you.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
Follow Current State on Twitter at KAR Current State, or you can email us about anything at any time, currentstate@wkar.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. She's a legend in the dance world, and tonight she'll be on the MSU campus at the Wharton Center. Choreographer, Kennedy Center honoree Twyla Tharp comes to East Lansing tonight as part of her 50th anniversary tour. Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke with Twyla Tharp and joins me now in Studio S. So, Jamie, this is a 50th anniversary tour. Will tonight's show be a greatest hits compilation or what?
Oh, like a some kind of Now That's What I Call Dance Volume 83. No. There's going to be two new pieces by Twyla in tonight's performance. One will feature a signature genre of hers, kind of early jazz, while the other new work goes back a couple of centuries earlier, Preludes and Fugues, which utilizes music from Johann Sebastian Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier. Now, if you played all those Bach Preludes and Fugues back-to-back, then you'd have 4.5 hours of music. And I don't think you'd find a dancer or, you know, an audience, for that matter, willing to go for that long. So how did Twyla Tharp start paring down this magnum opus by J.S. Bach?
Converting this massive exercise series into a theatrical event, I had to take into account a couple of things. One was to respect Bach's original intention so that the movement... I move in the direction he moved around the circle of fifths. I only fall back one time, I think, and that not very far, so that the subliminal construct that he created, which was to move from key to key in a methodic fashion, which carries a progression, would be respected, even though I was going to have to do elisions between one key to another. And then the next point is the notion of making a kind of theatrical pacing for it. In theater, it's very difficult to sustain a very, very long fugue. And also, one needs to create a context in theater so that A has a way of getting to B, which is a very different consideration than what he had. So I would like to think that Bach could watch this with a grin once I'd explained to him really clearly what was going on. No insult intended.
But among the many selected portions of Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, there is one that dancer and choreographer Twyla Tharp finds a bit special.
The F-sharp minor, thematically it's heavy, and it's an exception to the rule because most of them are somewhat in the vein that Bach intended, which is to say they are... they present a genre within dance, whether it's a trio or partnering or kind of a juxtaposition, a kind of counterpoint. But this one is dramatic, and I feel that in the F sharp minor, there's a kind of profundity to it that I wanted to address dramatically, which I don't do for the most part with, and most of them are very structural. I worked for 5 years in silence because I am a musician, and I know music is very powerful and that people watch a stage and they respond first to the music. So I can put a phrase on a happy piece, an audience will be bopping along to the music and feeling that, oh, this is a pleasant dance, and then take exactly the same movement and put it on something more somber, and they'll go, whoa, this looks like a very different thing. I wonder what it's saying. So for 5 years, I worked without any music to try and understand something about what movement would communicate. My very first piece, which was in 1970-some-X, to use music in performance was called Eight Jelly Rolls. It was Jelly Roll Morton, and it was from the 1927 Red Hot Peppers album, which, of course, is a phenomenal accomplishment. And he liked to say that he invented jazz with that. I'll go along with that. You know, he was not without his own rooting. But the way that that group played is arguably, yeah, sure, it's one of the foundations of jazz.
The pianist heard there is Henry Butler, an alumnus of the MSU College of Music jazz program. It is Henry Butler and his rendition of Fats Waller's early jazz work Viper's Drag, which underscores Twyla Tharp's other new piece coming to the Wharton Center tonight, Yowzy. And whether it be Fats Waller, Jelly Roll Morton, or Johann Sebastian Bach, there's always been an old connection that draws Twyla Tharp to the 88 keys.
My mother was a concert pianist, and I grew up on keyboard music. I played keyboard music for like 20 years. You know, it's all about the legacy and the development of keyboard music in the American vernacular, right?
For 50 years, Twyla Tharp has been defining various movements in dance as choreographer. But does she ever think of herself as a perfectionist?
Well, perfection is a strange kind of word. It implies that something is perfect. And I don't think of anything as getting there. I think of perhaps getting it right, getting it to a point where I think it's recognizable, where the intention is clear enough that I can stand by it. But perfect is not really in my ken. Perfect is a little higher up than I get to.
During this current 50th anniversary tour, it took Twyla about 20 performances to get the dancers, music, and the lighting cues to that level of acceptability. However, there are some elements that she's willing to leave to some of the performers in the moment, and she embraces that. But there is a word that she avoids whenever possible when dealing with changes.
Improv is improv is improv, right? I mean, you can be starting from scratch. You can be this hideous word. I don't like it much, but everyone uses it, called tweaking, right? Tweaking, which is to say you just give a little nudge and it like shines a little better or it rings more brilliantly. So you're, you know, constantly tweaking. I'm still addressing a few production points, that is to say, a lighting cue that's shifting on the downbeat. Should it be going on the upbeat? Let's try it on the upbeat tonight and see about that. But beyond that, the dancer's material is now pretty much intact. However, there are very small parts of the show that have a kind of liberty to them, but not for all the voices, not for all the parts, only for those who have a lot of experience in this area with me. For example, John Celia and Ronnie Todorovsky have been in all three Broadway shows. So I know them. I know their choices. I know they're great actors. So I give them places where they're at liberty, if you will, for X number of bars to accomplish X thing, but their way of doing it in a show is left for them to find in that show, because this is a way that we can, like any musician, jazz musician certainly can keep it fresh, although so did classical musicians did the same thing with the cadenza, right? Mozart's cadenzas are free-form improvs.
So with all the acclaim Twyla Tharp has received for her work over the past 50 years, two Emmys, a Tony and a Drama Desk Award, a MacArthur Genius Grant, a National Medal of the Arts, as well as being a Kennedy Center honoree in 2008, how much reflection does she do on her accomplishments, particularly when she's touring with a new company and new dance pieces?
You know, it's a singular point in time. 50 years is not nothing. On the other hand, it's not 60. So, you know, all right, we're still moving forward here. But 50 years have passed, and it was important to me in this 50th anniversary year to use the occasion to do new work so that I could actually see, okay, look, you began back here with a version of a fugue, which was in silence on an amplified stage, and it's now, let's just say, 50 years later. What can you do with the fugues? But rather than repeat the past, which is not of a huge lot of interest to me at this time, it's like, okay, what can you launch from this past career into the future? Or at least create an overarching theme out of it that you couldn't have done in the beginning. What can you do now you couldn't do then, right? And that was the approach to this evening, both to represent some of where I come from, but to do it in a way I could not have done then. You don't compete with yourself in the past, you move on.
Twyla Tharp's 50th anniversary tour comes to the Wharton Center on the MSU campus tonight for one night only. More information and tickets at whartoncenter.com. Twyla Tharp, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Be well. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And coming up on Current State, should Michigan allow commercial fish farms in Great Lakes waters? Proponents say expanding the aquaculture industry could be an economic boon for the state, but some environmentalists worry it could have an impact on water quality and wild fish populations. We'll dig into both sides of the issue with Dan Vogler, owner of Harrietta Hills Trout Farm and executive director of Michigan Trout Unlimited, Brian Burrows. And this week and next, Lansing's Peppermint Creek Theater Company stages a production of stories told by veterans and their families. We talk to director Blake Bowen and Jody Hancock, who will tell the story of her father's Vietnam service in Telling Lansing. That and more after this break. I'm not sure I've ever met anyone over the age of 30 or so who did not like the movie Chariots of Fire from the early 80s. The Oscar-winning writer who wrote Chariots of Fire has died at age 81. Colin Welland was his name, and you might remember him from the Oscar ceremony in 81, famously waving his Oscar and announcing in his acceptance speech, "The British are coming." That was a memorable moment at the Oscars. Colin Welland was 81 years of age. Its current state here on WKAR, should Michigan allow commercial fish farms in the Great Lakes? That's a question state officials are grappling with right now. Proponents say Michigan, with its rich water resources, could be a leader in responsible net pen aquaculture. But opponents say the possible economic gain isn't worth the environmental risks. Some state lawmakers, including Republican Senator Rick Jones of Grand Ledge, are hoping to ban commercial fish farms from operating in the Great Lakes or any of their connecting waterways. Today we hear from guests on each side of the issue. Dan Vogler is the owner of Harrietta Hills Trout Farm, which operates on the Ausable River. Mr. Vogler says that net pen operations can be a safe and sustainable form of aquaculture. Welcome to Current State, Dan.
Good morning.
And returning to Current State, Brian Burroughs, Executive Director of Michigan Trout Unlimited, which supports a ban on Great Lakes fish farms. Hello, Brian.
Good morning, Mark.
Dan, could you first describe for our listeners, and use layperson's language as best you can here, just what net pen aquaculture entails, please?
Well, what net pen aquaculture entails is... It can differ somewhat from site to site because different sites are different. But basically,
what's at the heart of it?
What's at the heart of it is having floating net structures that house a population of fish in a specified area that you feed and grow, and then come back and harvest. So it's the nets can be different depending on the requirements of the individual site, but that's the basics.
Now, many people are pointing to the state's water resources as something to be leveraged. We hear again and again references to the blue economy. Talk to us about the economic potential for this.
Well, the economic potential for aquaculture in Michigan truly is significant. The Michigan Aquaculture Association, in conjunction with Michigan Sea Grant, put together a strategic plan that points to the possibility of a $1 billion industry, not necessarily all in net pens, but a $1 billion aquaculture industry potential for the state. So it would be certainly a significant industry.
Brian, State Senator Rick Jones has introduced legislation that would ban net pen aquaculture, both in the Great Lakes and their connecting streams. Michigan Trout Unlimited supports the bill. Tell us why.
Well, we believe that out of the all the available kinds of aquaculture, recirculatory systems that are closed, flow-through systems, and net pens, that net pens today cannot be done without causing severe damage. Mm.
Dan, how do you respond to those concerns?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, the Jones bill not only bans not only bans net pen aquaculture, but it would actually ban all of the existing fish farms that exist in the state of Michigan today. So it's quite the regressive piece of legislation. And then, in terms of the utilization of recirculating aquaculture systems as the sole source of aquaculture development for Michigan, I think, is a huge mistake to look that direction. Recirculating aquaculture is extremely expensive to build. It is also extremely expensive to operate, has very high energy consumption demands, and energy consumption is a major issue in terms of looking at the ecological impacts of agricultural food development systems. So there's some issues there, and you have to look at the track record of recirculating aquaculture. You're going to find that it's very, very limited in terms of success across the United States, and we really don't have commercial success in the United States except for systems that produce tilapia and sell into live ethnic markets. So it's a very specialized niche, and it's pretty well tapped out. So to produce fish truly economically and truly ecologically sustainably, we have to have systems that are both ecologically sound, and we believe that net pen aquaculture is ecologically sound for a number of reasons. And it also has to be socially sound, and it also has to be economically sound. And if the economically sound part of sustainability doesn't work, then you can't build those systems. So from an economic standpoint, you know, the recirculating argument doesn't work very well.
Dan, Brian Burrows has put a lot on the table here. Let me give you a minute or two to respond to what you just heard.
Yeah, thanks. So we actually feel the exact opposite when we talk about ecologically sound and economically sound. The recirculatory systems are responsible, sustainable, but they do have a startup cost because they are paying for equipment that helps them take account of all of their waste, contain their fish, their diseases. As a business model, it is taking full account of its cost of doing business. If you allow net pens or certain flow-through systems to operate, what they are functionally doing is passing on waste management costs to the public. They release waste into the environment, and that is a cost that they don't have to bear as part of their business. So from economically sound, no, they're, you know, net pens are the opposite of that in that they're passing along business costs. One of the reasons that recirculatory systems haven't been allowed to develop as they should is that they are paying for the startup cost of their equipment to do their business the right way. And every time we allow a net pen or a bad flow-through system to occur, we, the public, are subsidizing that form of aquaculture at the disincentive of the recirculatory systems.
Brian Burrows is the executive director of Michigan Trout Unlimited. We're talking today about the debate over whether to allow commercial fish farms in the Great Lakes and their tributaries. We're also joined by Dan Vogler, who's on the phone. Dan's the owner of Harrietta Hills Trout Farm in Harrietta, Michigan. I want to follow up with Brian, though, here before we come back to you, Dan. Michigan doesn't have any net pen fish farms on our side of the Great Lakes, but I know that Ontario actually has 7 licensed facilities, as well as 3 run by First Nation tribes. Some of these have been in operation since the 1980s. There don't seem to have been any major environmental impacts reported from those operations. Can't we look to those companies as models for potential Michigan-based aquaculture systems?
Well, I don't think that we can. The reasons I say that are a couple-fold. One, as we've been looking around for what is the Ontario experience, we found that in 1999, they decommissioned and shut one down in the North Channel that had severe ecological effluent limitation problems. They started monitoring within a couple of years after they decommissioned that. They were still finding environmental problems in that area.
Nine out of 10 would suggest that it can be done, that it could be done well.
Well, you know,
you're referring to one.
So. Yeah, their follow-up, they went out, the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources in about 2004 went out and they studied 2 other sites, and they found that in both of those cases, the outside of the permitted boundary of those net pens, they were exceeding severe effluent limits.
Dan, state officials are currently reviewing 2 permits for proposed net pen operations here in the Great Lakes. They convened a panel of scientific experts to make recommendations on how the state should proceed if they choose to permit these facilities on the Great Lakes. Now, those reports, which were released last week, recommended that Michigan take a cautious approach to the idea of aquaculture here in the Great Lakes, but starting with smaller pilot projects. Do you think that cautious approach is the right one?
Well, our industry has always recommended a properly regulated, cautious approach as we look at development. And I would have to take issue with Brian's evaluation of what happened in Canada. The Canadian system actually has been very successful, and there have been very, very few issues. And if you look at what happened in Canada in 1999, they did discover that there was a system that was out of compliance, and it was, taken out of service. And, you know, that's the type of adaptive management strategy that is suggested by the science panel review. If you look at it, it talks about a cautious approach with a slow ramp up and adaptive management, which means that you study what you are doing as you do it. And you determine whether or not there are negative impacts. If you're seeing trends you don't like, you adapt your management techniques. And it's all about developing a responsible industry that does take into account effects on the environment, and that you adapt to them. We need domestic seafood production in the United States, and you know Brian's assessment of recirculating aquaculture systems, I'm sorry, is simply wrong. I'm looking at this from the perspective of somebody that's been involved in the aquaculture industry for 18 years, and I have observed all sorts of production techniques, and we currently have a number of commercial uses of the Great Lakes, all of which have some sort of impact on the lakes, but we've decided that those impacts are acceptable based on the benefits that they bring, and we believe that type of evaluation can certainly show that aquaculture in the Great Lakes can be a benefit to the people of the state of Michigan and to our economy.
Brian, anything in particular to say in response to that?
Yeah, the panel reports, I mean, they accomplished quite a few things. One of them was to validate that all of the problems that we mentioned with net pens on the last radio show are absolutely true. You don't have to take, you know, an environmentalist opinion on it. That's what they validated. There's a lot of mechanisms of impact. And what Dan mentions is right. I mean, the panel did not actually say that we should experiment with the Great Lakes, but they said if we were going to allow this at all, it would have to be viewed as an experiment with an intense amount of monitoring done. They actually, in that report, also say that the cost of that experiment really needs to be borne by the citizens of Michigan and their taxpaying dollars. There's enough evidence in that report on all the different ways that these are damaging that there is no way that it's not going to cause impact. What the report says and what Dan mentions is it going to be an allowable amount of impact?
What kind of regulations are already in place here, though, for inland aquaculture operations in the state?
Right now, the extent of environmental regulations basically equates to the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination Permit, so NPDES permit, which gives somebody a permit to release a certain amount of effluents and do a certain amount of damage to water quality standards.
I have to intervene here a little bit. The fact of the matter is that those permits are very strict, and those permits are not the only permits that are required. There are also licensing of Michigan aquaculture facilities.
Yeah, there's other ones, but Mark was actually asking
by the Michigan
about
Department of Agriculture and Rural Development, and there are also potentials for intervention from the Department of Natural Resources. So talking about it strictly in terms of NPDES permits would not be entirely accurate.
We got 30 seconds. Somebody's got to have the last word, Brian.
Yeah, so the NPDES is far from a perfect thing. Dan's operation in Grayling, as it's proposed, that permit is setting an effluent limit that's 2 to 3 times higher than the impact threshold from the best available science. So the NPDES permit today is not an end result to protect us here. The economic impact from recreational fishing, I'll try to leave you with this, is $4.2 billion a year just from fishing in Michigan. It's 38,000 jobs. The ideal scenario of aquaculture expansion in Michigan is very, very minuscule for that, and it puts what we have in great jeopardy.
We've got to leave it there. I'm sorry to say we've been talking about the debate over whether or not to allow commercial fish farms to operate in the Great Lakes. Our guests today have been Brian Burrows, Executive Director of Michigan Trout Unlimited. Also on the phone from Harrietta, Michigan, Dan Vogler, owner of Harrietta Hills Trout Farm. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Now it's time for a current state staff music pick. This one is from producer Katie Cook. Katie, tell us what you picked.
This is a song called Breaker. It's from the band Deer Hunter's 7th album, Fading Frontier, which came out last month.
Breaking the waves, again, I know I tried. Over and over.
And why did you pick this track?
I like how the lyrics of the song are serious, but the sound is soft and dreamy. A lot of the songs on this album have that same feel. Deer Hunter is kind of an experimental noise rock band, and some of their past albums haven't sounded this calm. But critics are saying that this album is their warmest work to date.
Thanks, Katie.
Sure, Mark.
Jackknifed on the side street crossing. I'm still alive.
It's current state on 90.5 WKAR. Today is Election Day, of course. A reminder that the polls are open until 8 o'clock. Last May, we told you about a new project linking Lansing's Peppermint Creek Theater Company and the Texas-based Telling Project. Now, the Telling Project seeks to work with local theater companies around the country in staging theatrical productions of stories told by veterans and their families. Peppermint Creek is the Telling Project's first production in Michigan. This week and next, they'll stage the resulting work in Telling Lansing. Current State welcomes Telling Lansing director Blake Bowen. Blake, welcome. And Jody Roberto Hancock, who tells her father's story in the show. Jody, welcome.
Thank you.
Blake, we have veterans and their loved ones telling their own stories in a theatrical setting. How many stories will you be telling here?
Well, we have eight total cast members. We have two couples. So, but they're all eight individual stories, pretty much, and they tell the scope of their lives pre-war, during the theater of war, and then what happens when they come home and the after effects.
What have been the challenges associated with working with people who, for the most part, have never written a theatrical script or performed on a stage?
It's been a pleasure, actually. At first, I thought it was going to be really scary. But the beautiful thing is it really helped me and allowed me to go back to my roots. I'm used to dealing with veteran actors that there's a certain language and a lingo that you use, but I couldn't even use simple terms like upstage, downstage, tech, whatever, okay. You know. So I had to go to the foundation of just storytelling, and that's really what came out of it. And the cast members were just such a pleasure because they were game for anything I threw at them.
Well, they're eager to share their stories, I would think.
Absolutely.
I mean, they wouldn't be there at all if they weren't really passionate about this whole thing. Jody, we don't want to give your entire story away here, but you joined the Telling Lansing Project to tell your father's story. So who was your father? Fred Roberto Jr.
Yep, Fred James Roberto Jr. He grew up in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and joined the Marines right out of high school. He kind of knew his whole life he wanted to be a Marine. He was a career man, 20 years, and he was in Vietnam. He went in 1967 at an older age of 29 and was already a criminal investigator at that time, and loved the Marine Corps, always loved it. And
a criminal investigator in the Corps.
In the Corps, correct.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
How are you telling his story?
I am trying to honor his memory and let people know about him and the sacrifices he made for the country and through his service. And it's also very much a love story, his love for my mom, his love for his family, his love for the country, and his love for the Marine Corps.
You were how old when he died?
I was 12. He died pretty unexpectedly, pretty suddenly. The cause of death was from cancer, and there was evidence that it was linked to Agent Orange, his exposure in Vietnam. But never knew my dad as a sick person, never knew him as an angry or depressed veteran. He always spoke so highly of his time there and stayed connected with the Corps even once he retired. But pretty much did not hear the word cancer until after he died. They went in looking for something, and he never made it out.
But are these reminiscences that you have created or family members have created, or is it a mix of things, or what?
It's a mix. One of the things that I get to share in the show are some of his letters to my mom and my three older sisters. I was born about 2 years after he went to Vietnam, but my mom kept many of his letters. My parents moved 18 times in the first 16 years they were married. And so throughout the years and all those moves, she lost things, but she always kept some of her favorite letters. And so I am actually able to read some of his letters of how he saw things and how he felt about them and what he learned and how he grew and, you know, how he thought about his service in the war. And so some of it's his voice and some of it's my voice and my memories of him and what happened to our family.
We'd love you to read some of, you know, an excerpt from a letter here. We'll ask you to do that in just a minute.
Okay.
We'll remind our listeners that we're talking about Telling Lansing. This is a theatrical presentation of the stories of local veterans and their families being staged by Peppermint Creek Theater Company in Lansing this week and next. Jody Hancock is sharing her father's story in the production. Director Blake Bowen is also with us. What was it like to just see these performances kind of take shape? Blake?
It was fascinating. The first thing I asked everyone to do was to bring in some sort of memento, a picture or a letter in Jody's case.
Mm-hmm.
No expectations whatsoever. And what they brought me was just trunks and trunks of photos of military documents of the actual letters from the parents they use themselves. And so that very first rehearsal, without even knowing it, I started saying, okay, well, we have to show this to an entire audience. Mm. So we have a giant 12 by 20 screen behind our actors. And for instance, in Jody's case, as Jody's reading the letter, we see an image of the actual letter that her father wrote to her mother. So the audience can read along in his handwriting with the date and the coffee stains and all that beautiful stuff that really gives you an image of where he was at the time and place.
That is so intimate. Here. How much did your dad talk about Vietnam, Jody?
Not a lot. I wish I had had more memories. I think losing him at an early age, I never got to have those conversations with him about war. All my memories are very positive. How much he loved the Marine Corps, having the mementos around of all his years in service, the friends that he had that would still come and visit us and that he would visit, and him participating in some military groups. There was nothing about him being upset or angry about the war, and unfortunately, I never got a chance to talk to him specifically about his time in Vietnam.
But did you learn more just putting this performance together?
Yeah. Putting this performance together and even going back, in 2004, my mom found out about this program called the In Memory Day, and it's a program at the Vietnam Wall to recognize people that died as a result of Vietnam, but not in Vietnam. And so at that time, all his grandchildren and all of my sisters and I and an extended family met in D.C. He was honored in this program. And it was that time that my mom presented my sisters and I with a book of all the letters she had left.
Oh, my.
And so I had read them then. I reread them again this summer before I interviewed with Max, who wrote the script for us, who interviewed each of us and then wrote the script.
Mm.
And it's definitely, and not just me, but sharing them with my daughter as well, who's 16.
Oh, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Well, we've got time for a little excerpt here. Jody, why don't you read a bit?
Okay. One of the first ones is dated November 16th, 1967. Hi, girls. Do you miss me? Well, another 12 months and 3 weeks, I'll be home, so just sit tight. Since I've got so much to say, I thought I'd better begin now. It's lunchtime. What I don't finish now, I'll continue later. When we arrived, it was hot as hell, but also raining. About 2 miles to the south, we saw what appeared to be a mortar attack near Marble Mountain. All at once, I realized that the long trip was over and that I was finally here, where the action was. A strange feeling, to say the least. All in all, things aren't bad at all. It could be a lot worse. Let's hope it isn't. Please remember one thing, Pudge. The nickname for my mother was Pudge. And you must too, girls. I'm doing what I think must be done, and I'm proud to be an American, a Marine, and most of all, the only man in your lives. Love always, Rick. Mm. Love always, Daddy.
Jody Roberto Hancock telling the story of her father, 20-year U.S. Marine Fred Roberto Jr. in Telling Lansing. This is a production of the Peppermint Creek Theater Company in association with the National Telling Project. We're also joined today by the show's director, Blake Bowen. We're just about out of time here, though. This is happening where and when?
It's happening at Peppermint Creek Theater. It opens this Thursday, November 5th, and it'll run the 5th through the 8th. And then next weekend as well, so the 12th through the 15th. We're at the Miller Performing Arts Center at 6025 Curry Lane in Lansing, Michigan. And it's basically on the corner of Miller and Cedar, just down from the Meyer there.
It sounds like a great presentation. We look forward to it, and we thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
All right. That's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, award-winning author, political activist Barbara Ehrenreich is heading to East Lansing to deliver a lecture about inequality in America and about how she's seen life for the working poor shifting in the wake of the Great Recession. Barbara Ehrenreich tomorrow, and voters making their way to the polls today to cast their vote for the Lansing and East Lansing City Council elections. Keep in mind, we'll have the results and talk with the newly elected members of the East Lansing City Council. All that and more tomorrow on Current State. Peter Wharf is our executive director. April Van Buren directed our show today. Big thanks to Scott Pohl, Melissa Benmark, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and Drew Hill. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.